Looks familiar. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Charles.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Great, man. So, you just released a new book, right? So we had Zero Day, but we're going to talk about a different one today.
Right.
What's going on?
It's called the Sysinternals Administrator's Reference.
Yep.
And I actually wrote it with a co-author who's sitting right next to me.
Hello, you are...
Aaron Margosis. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. So let's talk a little bit about, is this the first book you've written about Sysinternals to this degree?
Actually, there's only two books that I've written. The Windows Internals book, several editions, and then Zero Day, so this is the third.
Wow.
So, yes, of course, it's only one on Sysinternals. All the Sysinternals tools are covered in the Windows Internals book, but not to the depth that you've got it here, not the across the whole, all the tools. All 70 tools
Amazing.
Are described in this book.
That's excellent. Now, just to talk a little bit about the tools you wrote in the past is what informed you to dig really deep and understand the Sysinternals stuff, in terms of the Win internal stuff.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
So your history there is interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I used the tools to learn, just in the writing the tools, learn about the system, and then a lot of the tools showed me how the system worked after I was done with them. So.
Okay.
And then they helped out other people as well.
So how did Aaron get involved? Aaron, how did you get involved with this process?
Well, I've known Mark a long time. I've been using his tools for a really long time, since the 1990s. And, of course, I knew of him before then when he made his mark, as it were, by proving to the world how bad NT4SP2 was. But he was working with another co-author, and I was doing technical review, and that co-author decided it was taking way too long, it was way too much of a time commitment, and he had to back out. And my first reaction was, damn, that book needs to be written. I wish I had time to do it. I don't have time to write it, but I wish I did. And over the next few hours, I talked myself into believing that I could do it.
This is like 1 in the morning, isn't it?
It ended up, 3 in the morning, I sent you an email lesson. Anything you write at 3 in the morning, sit on it. Don't send it right away. I said, hey, maybe I can help you with this. Maybe I can take it over. Mm-hmm. And he asked me to write the process monitor chapter just to see. He didn't say yes right away, but he wanted to see what my writing was like, what my organizational skills were like, and he wanted me to see whether I wanted to do it, whether I enjoyed the process of it and could see it all the way through. And he liked what I provided, and we went forward.
Excellent. I mean, clearly, to write about process monitor, you'd have to really understand what it's doing. So I'm assuming that was also a little test.
I think you do, don't you?
I'll wing it.
So actually, the cool thing about Aaron is that he is a little bit anal, kind of. So
okay.
It wasn't just good enough for him to talk in vague terms about certain features. He had to check each and every one. So there was a flurry of bug reports that would come out of, he'd be working on process monitor and say, oh, when you do this, this, and this, then there's a bug. It's like, nobody does that, Aaron. Well, but then I have to fix it. I can't leave something like that go. So
sure.
I ended up fixing lots of bugs.
Excellent.
Nobody cares about except for Aaron. But
this is cool. I mean, right now people can have one source of information. This is, of course, available online as well.
Yeah.
So everybody out there, we're going to do the pimp session. Buy both of those books, but particularly buy the one that we're talking about today.
So it's actually 400, including the index. It's about 450 pages. Covers all 70... tools and 70 plus, and the major ones like Process Explorer gets its own chapter, which is
nice.
60 pages. Process Monitor gets its own chapter, which is about 45 pages.
Wow!
And then we've got a section in the back after all the tools, which are some of the chapters are just categories of tools like file and system and Active Directory. That we've got a section in the back, which is the case of the unexplained, which is troubleshooting.
Perfect.
If anybody's ever seen the case of the unexplained webcasts from conferences like TechEd, I show real-world cases and the tools being used to solve them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's about 20 of them in the book.
Excellent.
Some of them never, a lot of them never before.
Cool. Published. No, this is great. I mean, people have been asking about wanting to come and have a conversation with you about Sysinternals. So this is a great thing. Book's out. Awesome. People are going to definitely go buy it. There'll be a link on this post. So you mentioned 70-plus tools.
Yeah.
And you clearly have like 3 or 4 super popular ones, the ones you've dedicated chapters to, right?
Yeah.
How have these evolved over time?
So, actually,
the main ones.
First of all, I have to do a shout-out to Bryce because Bryce, I founded SysInternals with, actually we founded at NT Internals back in 96, and then we both came to Microsoft at the acquisition. We founded WinInternals together, and we both went to Windows. Late in the fall, he actually retired from not just Microsoft, but he's retired.
Retired.
He's running around the world, enjoying himself, and if anybody sees him, tell him I'm looking for him.
Okay. Right on.
And so anyway, back to your question about the evolution of the tools, there's 70 today. A lot have been retired. I mean, there's probably another 70 tools that have been retired in the last, because it's 15 years, so tools come and, you know, get obsolete and get incorporated in other tools.
Or some of the tools actually end up becoming things that ship in Windows. So there's some tools he doesn't need to ship anymore because Windows now does that.
Why doesn't Windows ship Process Explorer?
That's a very popular question.
Yeah.
And there's a few reasons for that. One is the functionality it provides. It's really everything in the kitchen sink as far as what you can see about what's going on with processes and threads. And most people don't understand past the veneer.
Okay.
I mean, the audience, hopefully, that's watching this, they do, but 99.9% of people don't. And the people that do are almost certainly familiar with SysInternals.
Okay.
And so they can, because they're familiar with it, they can go get it. Mm-hmm. And not shipping in Windows means that I can update it on a really frequent basis, very light touch.
Basically, whenever he wants to.
Yeah.
Sure. Makes sense.
So
plus, also another thing about it is, if it shipped in the box with Windows, it would have to be supported as long as that product was supported, which can mean 10 years.
Sure.
You know, so you know, some minor bug that happens to be a security issue, 10 years from now, we still have to be releasing patches for it. So
keeping it up keeps it very lightweight. It's just me now. Mm-hmm. Bryce is gone, so I'm the one that owns all the tools. Bryce used to own some of them, and we co-owned some of them, but now I own them all.
And just to say, you're coding these in?
C and C++.
Of course.
Yeah.
So, there.
Yeah.
I wanted to get that out there.
Yeah.
I mean, you're a native dev.
Yeah.
Although and you also write SQLite.
And Windows Azure, it's managed code. So.
But let me ask you that, though. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't have to be managed code. I mean, I know there's work being done where I could. But what if I wanted to deploy a super performant, super capable, super tested, widely used math library written in C and C++. Why can't I run that in Azure?
No, you can.
Okay.
I might have been misleading there.
Yeah.
You can run whatever code you want in a Windows Azure application.
Rock and roll.
HTML5, C, C++, Python, Java.
Beautiful.
You know, whatever. But when I say manage code in Azure, like the Fabric controller, which is the Azure kernel, it's written in manage code.
Written in C#.
C#, yeah.
Wow. You hear that, everyone? So we finally got a managed kernel, man.
Yeah.
Just had to wait until we invented Azure.
Yeah.
I remember having a conversation with Chris Broom many years ago.
Yeah. It's a little bit higher up than stack. It's distributed on kernel.
Totally. And then we had a conversation about that earlier, about that. You've done a lot of great talks about that. So going back to this, one question I have for you guys is, why did you deprecate Rootkit Revealer? I mean, come on,
That's another question I get. Because when I published Rootkit Revealer, it's kind of interesting. I published it. It does a cross-view scan of the system. And it was immediately, I was in a tit-for-tat with this guy named Holy Father. He called himself Holy Father.
Ah.
He wrote this Rootkit kit package that he would made freely available. Anybody could get it and modify it, called Hacker Defender.
Okay.
And a few weeks after we released Rootkit Revealer, we got a call from Microsoft PSS, or an email from PSS, that said, hey, we've discovered Hacker Defender on a customer machine, and Rootkit Revealer doesn't see it because we found the Hacker Defender configuration file, and it says don't hide from Rootkit Revealer.
Okay.
So Hacker Defender can say don't cloak stuff from these processes, and one was Rootkit Revealer, so Rootkit Revealer didn't work. Mm-hmm. So we came up with countermeasures for that, and then he came out with countermeasures, and then we did, and then he retired, actually. So I guess he made enough money off of Hacker Defender that he could retire.
Okay.
He's driving a Bugatti around Europe, Eastern Europe someplace.
More power to him, man.
But anyway, so either that or he's in a prison in Siberia.
Or he changed his name and he's still in the business in a bigger way.
Yeah.
Anyway, so and then once Rootkit Revealer came out, you started to see other antivirus companies incorporate rootkit detection and same kind of techniques. F-Secure had something called Blacklight that they did the same kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so Rootkit Revealer basically became something that I couldn't maintain any longer.
Okay.
And it's very easy to defeat. That's one of the problems with anti-malware software, is that the malware guys can look, study it. You have to publish it, they study it and figure out how to defeat it, and whereas you can't always see what they're doing to defeat it, so you don't know. It'd be different if they had to publish their stuff, and then you could look at it and go, okay, this is how we defeat their stuff, and it'd be a little more fair, but it's not fair, and it's just, it outlived its kind of usefulness. It was useful for a while. It kind of highlighted the rootkit problem. It got,
you know, you discovered the Sony rootkit.
It did. That was pretty...
that was you.
Yeah, that was pretty...
That was your code.
That was rootkit revealer.
Rock and roll. I mean, in some sense, keep untrusted code out of the kernel. That's a whole different topic. Yeah. We were going to do that in 2003.
I must point out that the reason he got infected with the Sony rootkit was because he wouldn't listen to me. He'd always run as admin on Windows XP.
I did.
Excellent.
I laughed at him, and then I paid the price.
So we're now living in the age, I know you guys, you know about C++ AMP, for example. We mentioned that we're working on that. It was a really nice, bringing C++ to the GPU, general purpose GPU programming. Speaking of GPU, do your tools work with GPUs?
Actually, that's a great question, Charles.
It's not what you have up on your desktop or anything.
Actually, I've got Process Explorer up here.
Okay.
Now, Process Explorer, a lot of people know, monitors CPU and memory and processes and threads and handles and DLLs. But one of the things I decided to do, and I'd been working on this for a while with help from some of the guys on the DirectX team, was to add GPU support to it. And this September is going to be the 15th anniversary of the founding of SysInternals.
Right on.
This is Process Explorer version 15. And coincident with the release of the book, I published it, and it's got GPU support in it now, which is, it's not in this edition of the book, so you'll have to buy the second edition to get the GPU information.
That's fine. We're ahead of the curve here.
But let me just show you quickly how you can see GPU. You can see GPU on a system-wide basis over here in this new tab called the GPU tab. And I'm zooming in here with Zoomit, another SysInternals tool. So you can see our GPU usage when we zoomed in went to about 16-17%. Here's dedicated memory usage across all the processes in the system of about 80 meg, and shared memory usage about 44 out of a total of 3 gig potential shared memory, which is shared in RAM, and a total of a limit of dedicated, which is on the GPU itself of 214 meg. But one of the things that I have to do, these GPUs consist of many nodes, they're called, which have engines on them, and the nodes serve different purpose. Only one of them is the engine that people think of for 3D acceleration, which is the one we see busy right here. I have a heuristic where I pick that first one, the first engine, first node. I call them engines here because that's what people think of. This machine has actually 7654321 engines on the GPU.
Nice.
The one you can see that's been used when I zoom, you saw that here I unzoomed right there. Here I zoom. Is the, and you can see, it's DWM is the responsible process. That these other engines serve other purposes.
Okay.
And why don't we exercise one of them? I got a Windows Media Player file here, Microsoft's Modular Data Center. If we press play and come back, you can see two other engines got busy.
Nice.
And it's actually Windows Media Player that's doing that. So I show the big 3D engine by default. That's what's checked as what you see up here in the main usage. But you could say I only care about the video rendering engines. I want to see usage of that globally. And you could select that. That's why I let you pick which ones you want to see. But the main 3D engine is the
one that's picked by default. How do you know which engine is which?
You don't know. Only experimental. Only because there's no there's no enforced guidelines or policy. I mean, it's up to the graphics driver to assign node IDs to their engines. So I just happen to be lucky that every engine, every graphics card I've seen, and I've looked at a whole bunch, assigned the big 3D engine to ID 0.
Okay.
So that's the one I show by default. And besides this per the system-wide view, you can also add per process columns to look at usage. And I've added these columns, GPU, GPU shared memory, GPU private, and GPU committed memory. And there's a few processes that are using it. Here's Media Player, which is using 32 meg of shared
GPU memory. Here's DWM using 5 meg. Mm-hmm. And is there anybody else? Well, there's CSRSS. It's got 8 meg, and it's actually consuming CPU, okay. some GPU, rather. And then you get per-process graph. So let's go back to Windows Media Player and then go to its GPU graph and then play again, and you'll see it spin up here in GPU usage.
Nice.
As it uses the GPU. Well, it's actually not using the big 3D GPU. I have to do this. I have to go do... pick those engines that it's using to be the one that we're using, doing the calculation off of. And now you see that's how much of the total video acceleration engines nice. It's using, 30% of it. So that's a quick look at GPU support.
This could also be really, I mean, as we were talking earlier, for general purpose.
Yeah, actually, so I got an email from somebody that said, hey, I don't see, I'm using Bitcoin, which is GPU, mm-hmm. to do its calculations, and I'm not seeing it show up in the GPU usage. What's going on? It turns out it's not using the 3D engine, it's using a different engine. So they told them what I just told you. Yeah. Then they figured out they needed to go select that other engine to see that.
Excellent. To figure out. I mean, Now what about, of course, I don't know if you've tested this out or not, but I mean, Aaron, what if you have a GPU with 1,000 cores? How's this going to scale?
Mark.
Have you tested it?
Nope.
Okay. So what do you think about
it? I was relying on you to test it.
You missed the book deadline.
Excellent. I mean, because that's not uncommon.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. The GPUs that are out there today are...
Yeah. I don't have one of those, but...
Okay. You don't?
I designed my code to be highly scalable.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, of course it is. And portable.
It'll work.
Right on. Yeah. So speaking of portability...
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about writing these tools for other operating systems besides our own?
Yeah. In fact, I wrote a FileMon, which is a predecessor to Process Monitor. I wrote a version of it for Linux at one point. And then I retired it after a while because Linus screws with the Linux kernel. He doesn't believe in enforcing backward compatibility at the kernel interface level.
Okay.
So he ended up actually breaking how FileMon for Linux worked. He didn't like that technique that I was using, which is really the only technique that was general enough on all the Linux distributions to work to monitor it with system call traps. So he basically broke it, and I said, okay, screw that.
Understood. And I guess really one of the reasons I was asking that was sort of this advent and popularity of mobile devices and mobile operating systems, where this could be very useful dealing with trying to understand what's going on in a very constrained environment. Like, why am I using too much memory? Or even more importantly, in terms of this, would be, why am I using so much battery in that terms of power? Like, I could see a tool that could really help me understand where I'm not doing the right thing for constrained environments, battery, memory, blah, blah, blah. This would be nice to have sort of a mobile set of these tools. I don't know how that would work, but it should be doable.
It is doable. Okay. Right now, Windows Phone runs on Windows CE. So it would have to be, which is a different kernel.
Yes.
So you can't just take this code and just run it.
Which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
Because you've written very portable code.
Yes.
That's why you chose native code.
That's correct.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's not portable because it's just an unfortunate situation.
Yeah.
Windows CE, we won't go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about the book. And what are some of the least known tools? I mean, I know from personal experience, it's the big three that I use, right? And I'm sure there's a lot of other people. But then, of course, there's the professional sysadmin who you're targeting this book towards,
right?
The IT professional, we call them, whatever that means. But the people who actually want to know what's going on at very fine grained levels, what are some tools that people aren't that familiar with?
Well, there's also, besides the monitoring tools, there's also management tools.
Okay.
And there's utility tools. I'll let Aaron actually answer this one because
he's not talking enough. I mean, yeah. He's a good listener.
He probably remembers, some of the tools I haven't touched in a long time. So he's more familiar with them now than I am.
That's probably true. DebugView, by the way, got a major rewrite as a result of the book.
Yeah.
So
explain. So DebugView.
It's better.
I'm not censoring.
It's better.
It's better.
Yeah.
He found some bugs.
Cool.
And changed the model, the client server model around a bit. There was when DebugView was originally written back in the 90s, there weren't host-based firewalls on every computer. Mm. So with that changing, Debug View basically broke. So that one's a big one. Let me think now. Probably the biggest one for me that I use outside of the main ones that everyone knows is probably SigCheck. And I use that, one, to verify are files signed, okay, and two, do they have a UAC manifest? And I also use it as a file ver, to get the version information out of a file. That's one of the quickest ways to do that from a command line. I spend a lot of time at the command line. So SigCheck is a big one for me.
One of my
log-on sessions is one, but that's for people who really want to dig. Yeah, I do. I run log-on sessions periodically to figure out, what LSA log-on sessions are existing on this machine right now. Should they all be there? Mm-hmm. Things like that.
Two of my second-tier kind of favorite tools, Zoomit, which I was just showing.
Awesome. I use that all the time. Yeah.
And the other one is DistaVHD, which I had so much fun writing that one. Okay. Which takes a VHD, or it takes a disk, so you could run it on this system, okay, and create a VHD that reflects the contents of the disk. Hmm. So they're kind of like a physical to virtual migration tool.
Nice.
So I actually went around when I wrote the tool and converted all my physical Windows systems into VMs using it.
Excellent.
It was cool to see ones actually, the nesting, like this machine running on top of this machine, for my Hyper-V system.
Yep, cool. Streams. I use streams all the time also. The main reason there is alternate data streams are used to tag files that you download from the internet to say this came from the internet. So you keep getting the warning every time you open the file. You can use the streams utility to remove those.
Okay.
So that's one of the things I do. I download something, I just go through the directory and just remove all the alternate data streams off of the files. So that's another important one for me. I use Zoomit all the time just as a screen magnifier because it works great as a magnifier. It
certainly does.
And at my advanced age, I need that.
Yeah, you don't have any gray hair. Neither. You don't age, and I think that's very weird, Mark. I want to tell you that. That's very strange.
I don't know the secret.
What's going on?
Healthy living.
So,
being immature, staying immature, it keeps you younger.
So now that, we live in this sort of, but at least we have for the past 6 or 7 years now, the concurrency revolution freakout. And how do your tools deal with things like distributed systems and exceptions happening God knows where in a kind of a distributed application environment? Do your tools make it easier for...
Well, actually, none of the tools are really distributed.
Okay.
Debug View is the one that comes closest, I think. Yeah. And I plan on actually updating Debug View to show Windows Azure trace output.
Nice.
So you could spit out trace output from a running
and
service.
Even there, the only thing it really does in a remote sense is debug events that happen on this machine can be viewed on this machine over here.
Yeah. Okay.
But other than that, most of them, PSExec can be used to run processes on a remote machine. Mm-hmm. But other than that, process monitor is just reporting this is what's happening on this computer right now. Process Explorer on this computer.
But in some sense, when you think about where Mark is these days, working on this operating system in the sky, I could imagine that these tools at some point will start mapping, the operating system kernel that you work on. That's this distributed kernel written in C#, as you talked about.
Yes. So, I'm working at the kernel level in Windows Azure, and there's definitely need for tools like this there, and they're being developed, and there's a bunch used internally. But system kernels is public available, and so those kinds of tools aren't useful to people. So I'm still in the what's useful to people, trying to figure that
out
for tooling.
Makes sense.
Kernels.
It makes sense. I mean, of course, no one's really going to be messing around with the Fabric controller in reality. Now, so what about developers? Like people like me, people watch Channel 9, we use these tools really for, as you said, Debug View and really trying to understand what the hell is our code actually doing and why did this behavior happen? It's the best debugging help in the world, in my opinion, is tools like this. Do you ship your code to or just the binary?
Just the binary.
Okay, so you can't talk about how
it's available to groups internally, of course.
Understood. Because, some of the complexity with the GPU, understanding what the GPU is doing, is you have to program at a really low level. What Can you talk about what APIs you're using at all?
They're internal.
Internal only.
Yeah, internal DX kernel APIs.
Perfect. So, but I had to ask you.
The tools are actually considered part of Windows, even though they're shipped in the box, and that allows them to use the undocumented APIs.
Absolutely. But then again, it really is focused on Windows, period.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing. Aaron, so we didn't really talk about what you do in your day job. I mean, you work for the government. I mean, you're a spy or what? What's going on?
I'm a full-time employee of Microsoft. Mm-hmm. I work in the consulting group, Microsoft Consulting Services, and U.S. federal government customers are my primary customers.
Mm-hmm.
And I work with them in a variety of ways. Sometimes I write code. Sometimes I help with security configuration. Sometimes I help troubleshoot why does this app work when we take away admin rights and things like that.
Totally. So you're actually using these tools in practice.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Now I'd imagine
that was one of the things that made it possible for me to write the book, is I didn't have to ramp up from zero to do it. Otherwise, I wouldn't have considered doing it.
Understood. So thank you for actually making these tools. And the fact that you're still doing it is really cool.
Yeah. It's really cool.
You have a full-time job.
It's a hobby.
It's a hobby.
Yeah.
So do you have a life outside of this place? Or?
Well, this is.
Well, you go on vacation and write some internals tools.
Yeah.
Right on, man.
And novels.
And novels. Excellent. And they are related, by the way.
Yeah.
Sure, people have picked it up.
Yeah.
Excellent. Cool, Aaron. Hey, it's great to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Before we go, what's your favorite sysinternal tool, real quick? Favorite one? Bar none.
I run Process Explorer all the time, so... but Process Monitor, I can't give you a straight answer. Process Monitor is the single most important tool for troubleshooting.
Excellent.
My favorite tool?
Yeah, from the creator. What's your favorite tool?
Zoom in.
Unbelievable, really?
Yeah. No, it's like asking me to pick my favorite child.
I knew you were going to say that. Right on. They're all great.
Yeah.
He has one child. I don't see why that's a problem.
Nice. Cool. Hey, thank you so much. Great to talk to you, Mark. We could keep on going, but I know you guys got to get back and do your thing. Let's point people here again. I really want people to read that book and also this one. In fact, I think it would be a great idea for people out there to get both of these books. Read Zero Day perhaps first, and then kind of go through there, and then kind of go back and forth and go, oh, no. All right. Everybody, stay offline.
Yeah.
Take care, man.
Thanks, Charles.
Thanks.
Nice to meet you, Aaron.
Nice to meet you, too.